Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 257, Rorke's Drift Part 1, Defiance, Disobedience and the Aftermath of Sandlwana. Rorke's Drift was a battle that Cetshwayo Kampani did not want because it took place on the western bank of the Umzinyathi, the Buffalo River, inside Natal. The British had been routed at Sandlwana by the main Zulu army, regiments whose names are still venerated by oral historians today, the Nkandampemvu, the Nkonkenke, the Ududu, the Mbube, Sanku, the Mbonambi, the Ngomamakosi. The men of the Utoana in Ndlondlo, in Luryengwe, the Loko, had headed northwest during the battle to cut off Chelmsford's escape route, while the main army went to work eviscerating Durnford's men. The commanders of the main army, Nchingwayo Kamaholi and Mabumingwana Kandlela, turned back to Ondini, realizing that they had both good and bad news. The good news? Chelmsford's central column had been crushed. The bad news, it had cost the Zulu main army dearly, perhaps as many as 2,000 warriors, or more, along with a number of his most venerated Ndunas and Isinkosi killed or wounded. The things were not over in this corner of the British Empire because the reserve Amabuto were itching to wash their spears. They had chased the Sandlwana fugitives to the Umzinyathi, spearing them and shooting them down, and now the Utulwana in Ndlondlo, in Luyengwe and Idloko were going to ignore Cetshwayo's orders and cross the river into Natal. The Zulu king had spelled out his orders and stipulated in no uncertain terms that his men were to stay on the Zululand side of the border. He believed that when it came to negotiating peace, the fact that his men had not crossed the border would be in the Zulu's favour. Cetshwayo believed that if he could demonstrate the Zulu Empire posed no real threat to British interests or colonial settlements, he might yet avoid total destruction. He grasped, what many generals forget, war is fundamentally a political instrument. By confining all combat to Zulu territory, never crossing into British-held land, he could preserve the moral high ground. When the inevitable negotiations came, this restraint would be his strongest card, proof that the Zulus sought only to defend their sovereignty, not to conquer. It was this reserve force of between 3,000 and 4,000 men who were going to throw a spanner in the works. They were on the move in three separate contingents, with the younger men from the Idluyengwe in the lead, marching in open order in advance of the others. They pursued the fugitives across Sotondosi's Drift, now renamed Fugitives. The other two contingents began a few pre-battle moves. First they divided, then they wheeled about, then they reformed in an impressive display of commander control. They too marched off westwards in open order, sweeping the countryside above Sotondosi's Drift. Cetshwayo's aggressive half-brother, Prince Dabulumanzi, was in command of these reserve units. This was a break from decorum because Dabulumanzi was not actually a general in Cetshwayo's army appointed by the king, but his royal status meant he dominated proceedings. The other Ndunas of the reserve deferred decision-making to him, despite their disquiet, which would grow to alarm later in our story. Dabulumanzi was another of our interesting characters of South African history. He was notoriously unscrupulous, but quick of mind and flashing of eye, always taking great care in grooming his moustache and pointy beard. Settlers who knew him called him sophisticated. He dressed in fine European clothes. He loved a gin and tonic and was an extremely accurate shot with a rifle. Had he not been Zulu, you would have called him an excellent example of a well-rounded English rogue of the Victorian era. At 40 years of age, he was still all six-pack and finely tuned. He was, of course, of the House of Shaka, so he was fat about the legs, like his grandfather, Senzanga Kona. Indluyengwe commander Sibebu Kamapita had a terrible day. He was forced to retire from the field with a broken finger. It remained misshapen till the end of his days, a mark of the injury sustained in the war against the British. There's some debate about where the Indluyengwe forded the Umzinyathi, but most agree it was upstream from Sotondosi's Drift, where giant slabs of shale made it easy to cross the flooding river. They climbed the steep sides of the western bank and sat down to rest, taking snuff, which was and still is an important rural Zulu tradition. Some lit up their favourite smoke, Cannabis sativa, puffing a pre-battle narcotic. Meanwhile, the Utulwana and Lodlo and Udloko forded further north, crossing the Imzinyati a few kilometres away upstream of a gorge where the river flowed more slowly, close to the Bachi River confluence. It took these three Amabuto more than half an hour to cross, forming a human chain in water waist-deep, wading across in lines. A few Natal native horse-mounted troops saw them and opened fire, but they were chased off. The time, 1:30 p.m. on the 22nd of January, 1879. We know it was that time because high on Shiani Mountain above Jim's old trading store, Rourke's Drift, three men watched the Zulu with amazement. It had been a quiet day on the hospital setup in Jim's old house, so Surgeon Reynolds and Otto Witt, the Swede who owned Rourke's Drift, decided to climb to the top of Shiani to see what they could see. They were joined by George Smith, Escort's Anglican vicar. He had volunteered to serve as chaplain to the Natal Volunteer Corps and was on his way to join Chelmsford's column. It's always a difficult climb, particularly on a blazing hot summer's day. From the buildings, Shiani rises for 300 metres, a jumble of nooks and broken sandstone, but beyond here it rises more steeply. Boulders must be negotiated. Upon reaching the summit, it affords a spectacular, almost 360 panorama of the Imzinyati Valley, sweeping around the Biggesberg Ridge, across the drift on the left, past the Bachi Valley ahead, then around the cliffs where Sihayo's followers had made their last stand. Sant Luana is a little to the right. Beyond lie the broken ridges and gorges of the Imzinyati tumbling downstream. Witt, Reynolds and Smith struggled to understand what they were seeing through their field glasses. They were watching the Battle of Sant Luana unfold without fully realizing what they were watching. Then they saw the long lines of warriors moving between the camp and the river. These were the reserve Amabuto. The startled men watched the Zulu cross the Imzinyati, and after initially hoping there were contingents of the NNC, it suddenly became apparent they weren't. They were gathering now around 6 kilometres away from Rourke's Drift. The three observers watched the regiments take snuff. Then one of these regiments set fire to a house on a kraal. Witt was a matter of fact when he said later, "Number 1 company followed their advance guard at an easy pace. Number 2 started off, bearing away to their left, apparently in support of number 1. Number 3 company started off men straight for Rourke's Drift, who ran as fast as they could, followed by 10 others who took it more easily. Then came on the rest, headed by 2 very corpulent chiefs on horseback." Prince Dabulumanzi wanted to give his men a victory. They could hardly return home and become the laughing stock of the nation. Zibebu's incapacitation provided him with a perfect moment. Later, it was spun that this smallish group of reserve Amabuto were actually on their way to Pietermaritzburg, and it was only the plucky Rourke's Drift defenders who stood in their way. That's an inaccurate reading of a military situation. These warriors had already been on the move for more than 20 kilometres. They had forded a flooding river that had very little to eat, and they knew the main army was not going to join in. All they wanted was a battle for pride, wash their spears, take some cattle, a few uniforms and British rifles, perhaps snippets of skin and beards for Muti. Those settlers who shuddered in fear that all the black-skinned Natalians would join the Zulu if they invaded may have lived amongst Africans, but seemed to have no clue about how intra-African conflict worked. Settler Walter Stafford summed it up when he said, "If that invasion had happened, all the Natal natives and Cape natives would have joined him as a matter of policy to save their skins. It's too awful to contemplate what the result would have been." This made no sense, considering the fact that Amatembu and Amamfengu were fighting alongside the British against the Zulu, not to mention other refugees from the Zulu Civil War who were amongst the NNC. They wanted to fight the Zulu. At Rourke's Drift, Lieutenant Gonville Gunny Bromhead was in charge of Bravo Company of the 2nd and 24th. 33 years old, descended from a titled Lincolnshire family, his great-grandfather had served under General Wolfe in Quebec. His grandfather was a lieutenant general who fought in the American Revolutionary Wars. Both his father and uncle had fought Napoleon. Bromhead's 2RC was Colour Sergeant Frank Bourne, and at 5'2", underwhelming at first glance. But as they say, dynamite comes in small packages. The undersized sergeant managed a company that was under strength and mixed. Bourne was from Sussex. His men were farm workers from Gloucestershire, Leicestershire, Devon, as well as working class men from the slums of London, Manchester and Birmingham, along, of course, with a smattering of Irishmen. a typical British Army regiment of the third quarter of the 19th century. They'd fought in the Eastern Cape against Amaxhosa, where their numbers had been bolstered by an influx of recruits, mostly from Wales. There were five men named Jones in Bravo Company, four named Williams, and none were related to each other, at least as far as they knew. Alongside them, auxiliaries, a company of the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Natal Native Contingent. These were the Amantembu from the Transkei. The 100 or so NNC were tasked with joining Chelmsford's main column, but at this critical moment, the 100 members were at Rorke's Drift. It was their job to guard the ponts, the ferry crossing points over the Imzinyati. Because the pont was at river level, it was lower than the buildings back at Jim's, and it was here, at the ramshackle hospital and supply warehouse, where soldiers cocked their heads at noon, because that's when the first sounds of gunfire could be heard from the direction of Sandlwan. Already, the Ndluyengwe were coming, along with Utulwana and Ndlontlo the Dloko. Several companies of the Utulwana had also followed their leader, Kuteka, after they tired of ransacking Sandlwan, seeking more blood, joined by their young mat carriers. High on the top of Shiani Hill, Surgeon Reynolds peered through his field glasses and saw that the Zulus were advancing, while ahead of them, white men on horses seemed to be galloping wildly away. Time was running out. Reynolds hurried back down the hill, followed by Witt and Smith. Earlier, and down at the river, Lieutenant John Chard had been musing about the meaning of life, having just concluded his lunch, when Lieutenant Gert Arendorf of the NNC interrupted. Arendorf had somehow made it from Sandlwana with a company of Amahlubi, managing to pick their way through the right horn of the Zulu, surviving the nightmare dash. During their flight, a group of African civilians had joined, driving their cattle away from the Zulu. These were Gamdana's people. They preferred to chance their luck with the British than the Zulu, who were likely to kill them all. Arendorf and another carbineer rode up across the river from where Chard was sitting near the moored pontoon, and soon the lieutenant and his carbineer survivor friend had been reeled over the river. Arendorf jumped off his horse on the Natal side and blurted out that his Sandlwana had been overrun. The army destroyed, that scarcely a man had got away to tell the tale, and that probably Lord Chelmsford and the rest of the column had suffered the same fate. Chard thought Arendorf was hysterical, and not in a funny way. I am afraid I did not at first quite believe him. While Chard prevaricated, a messenger galloped up from Lieutenant Bromhead, asking him to return to the hospital and material depot. Chard ordered the sapper, Driver Robeson, to pack up his equipment, loaded onto the wagon, and await orders. Sergeant Williams and six men of Bravo Company were stationed at the pont, told to keep watch on the river from the slopes of a nearby kopje. Back at Jim's, Bromhead was joined by John Dunn, the former gunrunner for Tetshwayo Kampandi, who'd switched sides. From their vantage point, they'd seen Arendorf and the carbineer gallop up to the ferry. They didn't have long to ponder, for that moment two other men rode up from the north, Privates Evans and Whelan. They had been among those Witt and Reynolds had seen through the field glasses, galloping wildly away from the Zulu Amabuto, dishevelled, wet from the river crossing, shivering, shaken. From his sodden pocket, Evans produced a scribbled note from his commanding officer, Alan Gardner, which stated baldly that Sandlwana had fallen and that the Zulus were likely on their way to attack Rorke's Drift. By that stage, Gardner, back at Sandlwana, was already dead. The news was so stunning that for a few moments Dunn and Bromhead froze, until acting assistant commissary James Dalton snapped them out of it. Dalton would go on to great things during the next few hours, with most regarding him as the true hero of Rorke's Drift. A Londoner, he'd been a sergeant of the 85th Regiment, now a pen pusher running logistics, but one with a stern spine and experience. In a low voice, Dalton pointed out that there was no option but to defend themselves. If they tried to make a run for it to help Makar to the west, the Zulus would easily overtake them, encumbered as they were with at least 30 sick or wounded men. Dalton suggested turning the two mission buildings into an improvised fort, using the stores as barricades. It's always the simplest ideas that come from the coolest logic. But he had experience of something similar. 18 months earlier, he'd been fighting the Xhosa at Ibeka on the Eastern Cape frontier. He'd earned a mention in dispatches for keeping mobile columns supplied. Efficient he was. Too efficient, perhaps, because Xhosa chiefs took note and targeted his garrison. Then he'd fortified the position with sacks of mealies and beans and wooden boxes of bully beef. which discouraged the causer from a direct attack. It's possible, according to historians including Ian Knight, that Dalton thought if they placed the post of Rorke's Drift into extreme readiness, the Zulus might leave them alone. As we'll see, nice try, but no. Bomber had ordered the post to be made ready to either fight or flight, but the decision had to be made by Lieutenant Chard. He was the senior officer. Bravo Company's tents were struck. A two-wheeled water cart was dragged closer to the buildings. Mealy bags and biscuit boxes pulled out of the storehouse to make a wall. Pickets posted. When Chard arrived from the river, he concurred with the view they should stand and fight. It was their only hope. When Jim Rorke built his trading store, he did not really take security into account. The two buildings were overlooked and hemmed in by mountains and bush cover. They were 30 meters apart, the house slightly forward, so its rear wall was in line with the front of the store, both on a shelf of rock that jutted out from the base of Shiani Mountain. That was 300 meters away. A wagon track wound its way towards the house from the drift, splitting into a Y junction 50 meters from the buildings. The front path continued past the store, while the other turned around behind Shiani, then onwards, downstream. There were a number of weaknesses which the British would have to deal with. First, the rocky shelf ran a few meters from the front of the buildings, then dropped off sharply, about 2 meters down. The second weakness is that they had not bothered to clear the ground between the ledge and the road. This area was covered in tall grass and thick bush. There was a half-finished stone wall in front of the house, 20 meters long, 1.5 meters high. But there was a bigger problem across the road beyond the house. Here, an orchard of fruit trees grew. At the other side, to the right of the storehouse, there was a solidly built calf pen, and below the ledge, a cattle kraal. Behind the house was a clay oven and a long drop, the toilet all South Africans of a certain age know. Both main buildings were thatched, the store about 25 meters long, 7 meters wide, the house, now a hospital, 18 meters long, 5.5 meters wide. The hospital was small and cramped, and as you've heard, some of the interior doors had been bricked up when the Stockel and Surtee family shared the home before Otto Witt purchased it. Lieutenant Chard and his men set to work. First, he paced out the line of the barricades, incorporating the calf pen but leaving the cattle kraal to the attackers. He connected the corner of the store straight to the rear of the house by dragging two ox wagons into line here and running biscuit boxes under the wagon beds, closing the gaps. Then they heaped up mealy sacks along the length, providing a solid wall over 1 meter high. The gap between the store and the calf pen was plugged with mealy sacks as well. It was the front of the post that was Chard's biggest nightmare. They'd have to stretch a line from the front of the calf pen across the storehouse all the way to the corner of the hospital. It wasn't clear that they had time to build this wall 30 meters long, but the topography helped because the rocky ledge I mentioned was the obvious place to build the wall. By the time they'd piled the biscuit and bully beef boxes and sacks along this ledge, it was 3 meters high. Chard wrote later in his report that a breastwork of bags of grain, boxes of biscuit, and everything that would help stop a bullet or keep out a man, an ox wagon, and even barrels of rum and lime juice were pressed into service. The pickets at the pond were called back, and the draft animals and horses, as well as all the cattle, turned loose. Surgeon Reynolds tried to evacuate his sick men, 30 of them, but only 8 could walk. The rest were so incapacitated that they were issued rifles and told to defend themselves where they lay. 6 men from Bravo Company were left in the hospital as backup, and Chard also left pickaxes and told the men to hack through the bricked-up doors, but they never did. This was going to do most in the coming night. As they toiled on their defences, a number of survivors from Isandlwana rode past, a depressing sight. Most had no jackets or hats or weapons. All were in shock. The horrors of the last few hours burned into their memories. Chard and Reynolds tried to keep their men away from these woe-begone fugitives, but word began to spread. "Not a fighting chance for you, young fella," Frank Bourne of Bravo Company was told by one. Otto Witt, who had remained at his home monitoring what the British were doing, couldn't stand it any longer. His best parlour was being pulled down, and loopholes were being knocked in his precious mission station. His splendid furniture scattered in the rooms. He thought of his wife and children in Msinga, saddled his horse and rode off to find them. His friend, August Hamar, went along too, along with one of the hospital patients, Lieutenant Purvis of the NNC, who had been shot through the arm at Sihayo's stronghold. He was also suffering from dysentery. Only the soldiers were now left. It was 4 p.m. As John Dunn said later, the men knew what was before them, a struggle for life, but they one and all displayed the greatest coolness. That was not entirely accurate. As you'll hear next episode, one of the NCOs was going to be shot. He lost his nerve and tried to run away before the Zulu arrived. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a newsletter. Until next, usutu.